Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The French foreign minister says a missing Algeria plane probably crashed, and the death toll from the Israeli-Gaza conflict surpasses 700. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Searchers are looking for an Air Algeria flight carrying 116 people that disappeared today en route from Burkina Faso's capital to Algiers. French fighter jets based in West Africa are taking part in the search. The French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, told reporters no trace of the plane has been found, adding that the aircraft probably crashed. Algeria's official news agency says the plane was last seen on radar as it flew over the Malian city of Gao after taking off from Ouagadougou. There were reports of storms in the area. A woman who received a death sentence in Sudan for refusing to recant her Christian faith has arrived in Italy along with her family. Miriam Yahya Ibrahim arrived in Rome today along with her husband and two young children. Italy joined with the United States in helping to free Ibrahim, and the country's vice minister of foreign affairs accompanied her on the flight from Khartoum. Israeli strikes in Gaza continued today, and rockets fired by Hamas-led fighters in the enclave landed in Israel as both sides maintained their conditions for a ceasefire. VOA Scott Bobbs reports from Jerusalem the number of Palestinians killed in the conflict surpassed 700, while the death toll in Israel rose to 35.
Israeli forces bombarded targets in the Gaza Strip, and Hamas-led fighters in Gaza launched rockets and mortar shells on Israel. Gaza health officials say an Israeli shell slammed into a UN-run school in the northern Gaza Strip, killing at least 15 people and injuring dozens more. The UN has confirmed the school at Beit Hanun was hit, but could not confirm the number of casualties. After meeting with British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Hamas militants are using Palestinian civilians as human shields and complained Israel is being criticized for defending itself. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Iraq's parliament has elected Kurdish politician Fuad Masum as the country's new president, hours after militants killed at least 51 prisoners and 8 policemen in an attack on a convoy north of Baghdad. Masum was almost assured the job after Kurdish parties struck a late-night deal to support him. Meanwhile, a senior UN official warns millions of people in Iraq are likely to face severe food shortages because of fighting in the north. The official says a seizure of large swaths of territory by Islamic militants has disrupted the normal harvest season. Lisa Schlein reports.
The United Nations estimates 1.2 million people are displaced from the conflicts in Iraq between the Shiite-led government and Sunni opponents. UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Iraq, Jacqueline Badcock, says aid workers are concerned about millions of people still trapped in conflict areas, particularly on the Nineveh Plains and in the city of Mosul. She tells VOA the country's food security is of concern because Nineveh is the breadbasket of Iraq. She says she does not expect a famine, but the chaotic situation in the country will seriously cut down on the amount of available food. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Gunmen in western Afghanistan have shot and killed two Finnish women working for a medical charity in the city of Herat. The women were members of the Christian group known as the International Assistance Mission and were shot by two men on a motorbike as they were riding in a taxi. The gunmen fled and have not been identified. The Herat Provincial Health Department said the victims died while being taken to a hospital. Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk has announced that he's resigning amid the collapse of Ukraine's ruling coalition in parliament. Mr. Yatsenyuk made the announcement today, hours after two of the political parties in the ruling coalition pulled out. People around the world waiting for U.S. passports or visas can expect delays due to a computer problem. The State Department says its global database for issuing travel documents has crashed. The unspecified problems have resulted in outages in the processing of applications for passports and visas. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A ceasefire deal agreed to by warring militias in the Central African Republic is a welcome development for the war-torn country. Implementing the accord will not be an easy task.
That's VOA's Gabe Jaslow reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, searchers are looking for an Air Algeria flight carrying 116 people that disappeared en route from Burkina Faso's capital to Algiers. And two Americans have been arrested and charged with running a fundraising network for Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia.
We'll have these stories plus sports with Peter Cloti, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Air Algeria says authorities continue to look for Flight 5017, which vanished from radar somewhere over northern Mali. It was on its way from Burkina Faso to Algiers. There has been no contact with the plane carrying 116 passengers and crew since early this morning on what should have been a four-hour flight. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Aviation authorities say they are searching for a missing Air Algeria flight that was traveling from Burkina Faso to Algiers. Kara Turkey, a spokesman for Air Algeria, said there has been no sign of the plane since around 3:30 GMT, about 1 hour before it was scheduled to arrive in Algiers Thursday morning. Since 5 o'clock this morning, we have been searching and continue to search to trace the signal from our plane that was destined for Algeria. But for the moment, the plane remains missing. We would like to have more definitive information, particularly for the families of those on board, but for now, we continue to search. Burkina Faso's Ministry of Transportation says that there were 110 passengers and 6 crew members on board, including 50 French citizens and 24 Burkinabe. They said most of the passengers were in transit to destinations in Europe. Security officials in Mali told VOA that the plane was last seen on radar over northern Mali, between Gao and Tisali, near the border with Burkina Faso. Officials said the plane requested to change routes about an hour into the flight because of stormy weather. It is not yet known if weather played a role in the plane's disappearance. Spanish airline Swiftair, which owns the MD-83 aircraft, said in a statement it continues to work with Air Algeria and local authorities to locate the missing plane. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
Australia has sent 50 police officers to London in anticipation of deploying them to eastern Ukraine to secure a Malaysian plane crash site as part of a proposed international team. Prime Minister Tony Abbott said foreign ministers from Australia and the Netherlands will go to Kyiv to iron out the details of deploying such a team under UN authority to secure the crash site in rebel-held East Ukraine. Meanwhile, two more planes are due to take off from Ukraine for the Netherlands, carrying dozens more victims of the shootdown of Malaysian airline flight MH17 last week. All 298 people on board were killed. Tens of thousands of mourners in the Netherlands held memorial services and ceremonies as the first bodies from flight MH17 arrived in the country yesterday. 193 of the victims were Dutch. Earlier today, Russia called on the United States to prove that the passenger jet was shot down by an SA-11 surface-to-air missile fired by Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov asked the U.S. to produce proof that it has technical data and satellite photos to back the accusation. U.S. intelligence analysts have concluded that a Russian SA-11 Buk missile downed the aircraft and that ill-trained rebels likely fired the missile, believing the aircraft was Ukrainian.
A ceasefire deal agreed to by warring militias in the Central African Republic is a welcome development for the country. But as VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports, implementing the accord will not be an easy task.
Leaders of the rival anti-Balaka militia and the Seleka rebels agreed at meetings in the Republic of Congo to end sectarian violence in the CAR. The deal, signed Wednesday by various armed groups, members of the transitional government and civil society, calls for an immediate halt to fighting that has left thousands of people dead and displaced nearly a quarter of CAR's population. While Seleka and Anti-Balaka are considered the main actors in the violence, various splinter groups have formed across the country during the past 16 months. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Louis Mudge says while the deal looks good on paper, getting the various rebel factions to comply will not be easy.
It's going to be very difficult for them to control all of their respective groups. There is a loose command structure over the Seleka, and there is a very loose command structure over the Anti-Balaka, but that by no way means that they control all of the soldiers or the combatants that fight in their name.
The conflict began when mostly Muslim Seleka fighters stormed the capital and overthrew former President Francois Bozize in March 2013 and installed the country's first Muslim president. In response to the coup and ensuing violence, mostly Christian militias formed under the name Anti-Balaka, sparking targeted attacks between the two communities. Tens of thousands of Muslims have fled the CAR, fearing violence by the Christian majority. Both sides have been accused of serious human rights violations. Mudge, with Human Rights Watch, says religious and ethnic divisions opened by the conflict will take time to heal.
You have homes in Muslim communities that have been literally taken apart brick by brick. So reconciliation and getting Central Africans back to their former communities are going to be very, very tense and very long processes.
Following the ceasefire agreement, warring factions are now due to begin negotiations on separate proposals for disarmament and the country's political future. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Two Americans have been arrested and charged with running a fundraising network for Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia. U.S. Attorney's Office allege that Muna Osman Jama of Ruston, Virginia, and Hinda Osman Dehrein of Kent, Washington, operated a network beginning in 2011. Legal papers claim the two women funneled support to Al-Shabaab ongoing rebellion against the U.S.-backed government of Somalia. The government claims they used the words orphans and camels to mean fighter, living expenses, and trucks. Jama and Dehrein appeared in separate federal courts yesterday. Three others who are overseas have also been charged.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Searchers are looking for an Air Algeria flight carrying 116 people that disappeared en route from Burkina Faso's capital to Algiers. A ceasefire deal agreed by warring militias in the Central African Republic is welcome development for the war-torn country. And two Americans have been arrested and charged with running a fund-raising network for Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. In the United States, the South bears most of the country's HIV burden. What's more, most of those infected are African Americans with few resources available for prevention, care, and treatment. A human rights group unveiled its study of the Southern U.S. at the 20th International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The Southern United States is made up of 17 states and the District of Columbia, or Washington, the nation's capital. The South is home to 37% of the U.S. population. And while African Americans make up 13% of the country's overall population, more than half of them live in the South. Megan McLemore is a senior researcher at the Health and Human Rights Division of Human Rights Watch.
What's clear is that the South is the center of the concentration of the epidemic as it currently stands in the U.S. The southern region has the highest HIV infection rates. It has the highest new HIV infection rates among ages 13 to 29. 44.6% of AIDS cases in the U.S. are in the southern region, which is double that of the next region, the Northeast.
McLemore says the South also has the highest fatality rates from AIDS.
All 10 cities in the United States with the highest AIDS diagnosis rates were in the South in 2011.
She says the epidemic has had a grossly disproportionate impact on minorities.
African Americans are 13% of the U.S. population, but 46% of those living with HIV or AIDS. And in the South, it's 55 to 60%. In many southern states, African Americans are approximately 30% of the population, but 60 to 75% of people infected with HIV. In Louisiana, for example, African Americans are 32% of the state population and 73% of those living with HIV.
Also, half of new HIV diagnoses among Latinos in the U.S. are in the South. The Human Rights Watch study links many of the HIV/AIDS problems in the region to poverty. It's the poorest region of the country.
The linkage to poverty with HIV is increasingly well documented. In the U.S., of 175 counties with the highest HIV rates and the highest poverty rates together, all but six are in the South. The South also has what we call the weakest safety net programs and also a failure to invest in HIV/AIDS.
McLemore says the economies of many southern states are not set up to generate revenue for HIV/AIDS-related programs.
Many of these states are the poorest in the nation, and they have the lowest budgets. But if you examine that more closely, you see that they also have the lowest tax rates on their corporations and on their high-income residents. So they have a self-fulfilling cycle of very low revenue, and then they try to use the absence of state revenue as an excuse.
Adding to the situation, she says, is the fact that the South has the most uninsured people in the country. Even though the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is in place, many southern states refuse to take part. The Supreme Court ruled that states do not have to expand Medicaid, a joint federal and state government insurance program. Medicaid provides health coverage for nearly 60 million children, families, pregnant women, the elderly, and people with disabilities.
11 of 17 southern states are not expanding Medicaid, despite having the highest rates of uninsured persons.
The legal battle over the Affordable Care Act continues in the U.S. Supporters and critics are generally split along Democratic and Republican Party lines. The Human Rights Watch study says many southern states rely on abstinence-based programs for HIV prevention for young people. It says that restricts health information about HIV. The study also finds high levels of homophobia and anti-gay messages in the South. Some states still have anti-sodomy laws on the books, despite being struck down by the Supreme Court many years ago. It also says the South has a very high incarceration rate, contributing to the spread of HIV in prisons, and very few needle exchange programs designed to limit the spread of the virus among injection drug users. McLemore says Human Rights Watch has dedicated itself to working on these issues.
International law obligates the United States to protect the right to health, which includes the right to disease prevention and information, the right to treatment and services. The United States is also obligated under the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination to protect equal access to public health services and to correct laws and policies that have disparate impact on minorities.
She says addressing HIV/AIDS in the southern United States is a human rights imperative. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new report reveals that some 130,000 people living in Uganda's fishing communities have an infection rate that's 3 to 4 times higher than the national average for adults. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, launched the report after studying 42 fishing communities from 6 Uganda districts. The study examined the level of knowledge of HIV along with attitudes and practices of people in the fishing communities. The IOM found that the high HIV prevalence rates in these communities are the result of a complex interplay of factors. Dr. Natalia Gitu is the chief medical officer for IOM in Uganda. She spoke with me about the factors contributing to the high incidences of HIV in Uganda's fishing communities.
The study that our organization conducted and other studies that were conducted before have shown that the mobility of fishermen, the fact that they have everyday new cash that flows in their business, and it's associated with drinking alcohol and engaging themselves in unprotected sex. These are the factors that studies confirm that lead to increased prevalence of HIV among fishermen.
As you mentioned, there are various factors that are coming into play here in these fishing communities that have high risk of HIV/AIDS, one of them being not having accurate knowledge about the disease and how to protect themselves against HIV. What did the study say specifically about this?
Actually, the awareness about HIV in the community is very high. For instance, 89% of men and 88% of women were familiar with the most common means of HIV prevention. That is, they are aware that they have to use a condom and limit sex to one partner. However, the attitudes towards using the prevention were actually very different. The profession of fishermen considered to be very risky. They can lose their lives while they are fishing, and they don't value their life.
So then how do you go about changing the attitudes then about practicing safe sex?
We believe that the intervention should be appropriate to the local culture, and the needs should be specifically identified for various fishing communities. And we believe that any intervention should be tailored specifically to the fishing community based on their culture, on their attitudes and their beliefs.
Regarding the attitudes that are prevailed there in that area, is it primarily the men with this type of attitude? How do women feel?
Women among the fishing community, they don't go to the lake to fish. But since they depend so heavily on the men who are fishing and who are trading their fish, they very much depend on the sex because they have to get engaged with men who sell fish in order to have their jobs. On the other hand, in the fishing community, traditionally they believe that women can be shared by men. Women belong to the community. And then also the utilization of condoms and use of condoms is very low among the fishing communities. For example, when people engage themselves in unsafe sex, only 37% report that they use condoms and 18% of women. So the use of condom in fishing communities is very low. And that is also a big contribution to the spread of HIV.
And one of the other factors that was highlighted in your study was that getting access to treatment is very difficult. So how is this being addressed?
Over 80% of people reported that they went for treatment to health facilities when they feel symptoms of STD. However, health facilities are very far. Sometimes they have to travel 2 hours to go to those health facilities because the fishing communities are located in very remote areas. Therefore, bringing health services closer to fishing communities will definitely benefit men and women.
That was Dr. Natalia Gitu, Chief Medical Officer for IOM in Uganda. She spoke with me from Kampala.
The World Bank says Boko Haram threats and killings are making it difficult for agriculture project grants to improve the livelihoods of people in famine-stricken northern Cameroon, Nigeria, and southern Chad. World Bank Vice President Matra Diop is visiting Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
World Bank Vice President Matra Diop says agriculture, health and water projects in northern Cameroon and Nigeria and the southern parts of Chad are suffering setbacks due to Boko Haram activity. The $108 million grant to rehabilitate embankments, dams and irrigation systems and improve disaster preparedness in northern Cameroon, an area characterized by high poverty levels and vulnerability to natural disasters, is stagnating. After meeting with Cameroon President Paul Biya, Diop told VOA attacks from the Nigerian militant Islamist group Boko Haram have created panic in North Cameroon, southern Chad and Nigeria, thereby slowing the execution of some of the projects.
We discussed with His Excellency the President increasing the condition of peace and stability in the sub-region of Africa and try also to see how we can strengthen all the social protection programs to alleviate poverty. You know, the current security situation in that part of the subcontinent. So for us, strengthening the economic development in the northern part of the country is something essential.
Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of the far north region of Cameroon, also told VOA that World Bank grants to help restore rice production and provide food and income for the over 3 million people living in the area suffer setbacks as most beneficiaries and aid workers are leaving for fear of the violent Islamist group that launches assaults on Cameroonian villages regularly.
In the grand temps que les choses reviennent à la normale.
He says it is time for the security situation in North Cameroon to be addressed, and it can only be with the participation of all partners. He adds that they are constantly attacked by Boko Haram and are investigating the origin of war weapons they discover buried in some towns. Such situations, he concludes, scare people from working in the north. Investors are also leaving far northern Cameroon. Chinese road construction engineers left Mora on the border with Nigeria after 10 of their workers were kidnapped by suspected Boko Haram members. Cameroon, along with Nigeria, Benin, Niger, and Chad, declared war on Boko Haram last May after 276 girls were kidnapped from their school in Chibok in the state of Borno. According to Amnesty International, more than 1,500 civilian deaths have been reported amid increasing violence and assaults by the violent group in the past 5 years. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yeheyi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Searchers are looking for an Air Algeria flight carrying 116 people that disappeared en route from Burkina Faso's capital to Algiers. A ceasefire deal agreed to by warring militias in the Central African Republic is a welcome development for the country. And two Americans have been arrested and charged with running a fundraising network for Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia. Coming up, we have music from Liberia. And in our feature segment, we focus on two African leaders who embrace legislation which targets the gay community. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Peter Cloti sitting in for the vacationing Sonny Young. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Kim.
Well, I understand that Sierra Leone football tops your sports report today.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Kim. And FIFA, the world governing body, says it will support Sierra Leone in the fight against match manipulation. This came after the president of the Sierra Leone Football Association, or SLFA, Aisha Johansson, met with FIFA President Sepp Blatter and Secretary General Jerome Valcke to discuss measures to tackle the wave of match manipulation allegations in Sierra Leone football. It was agreed that FIFA's security division would assist the Sierra Leone FA in its fight against corruption and match manipulation in two ways. One, by supporting the investigation conducted by the SLFA, and by assisting it in setting up its own national integrity program. Nigeria's Minister of Sports, Tami Danagogo, says that Nigeria has what it takes to break the round of 16 jinx at the World Cup. Super Eagles, in its five World Cup appearances, has reached the second round thrice, and thrice has crashed out at that stage. The first was in 1994, losing 2-1 to Italy. In 1998, the team lost again 4-1 to Denmark, while in 2014 in France, France sent them packing with a 2-0 defeat in Brazil. Speaking when he received members of the Club Owners Association in Abuja, he noted that the major problem plaguing football is, quote, the failure of football managers to harness and develop the potential in the country. Controversial Uruguayan striker Luis Suarez could make his Barcelona debut against rivals Real Madrid with the first El Clasico of the season set for the weekend of October 26. Suarez, who signed from English club Liverpool, is serving a four-month ban for biting Italy defender Giorgio Chiellini during the World Cup in Brazil. He was banned on June 26, which means the striker could play for Barcelona as they face Real Madrid. Suarez was banned from all football-related activities by FIFA and cannot train with his new club, and is prohibited from entering the confines of any stadium. To Cameroon, and officials of the Cameroon Football Federation, or FECAFOOT, announced at a news conference yesterday that they will be stepping down at the end of the year. For details, I spoke with Nana Walter Wilson, sports editor for the Post newspaper in the Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
Yeah, you know, after the World Cup, we've not heard much about the Cameroon Football Federation, the officials of the normalization committee, but they held a press conference recently, and they came out with some exciting statements that, first of all, they are actually going to leave office on December 2, 2014, which means that the statutes that they drew up, that the revision committee drew up, the revision and legal committee drew up and sent to FIFA, has been validated. And so they were making it public to the press in particular, and that elections are going to hold beginning in the month of October, November, and then finally those who will be elected will now get into office officially on December 2, 2014. So the statute now gives the precision on who can be a candidate for the top job of the Cameroon Football Federation.
What prompted them to decide to leave office?
No, you recall that after the last meeting they had with FIFA, where the FIFA representative, Mr. Kovaru, came to Cameroon about 2 months before we went to the World Cup, it was clear that they are expected to leave office at the close of November 2014. So they have now come back, they have not looked at their schedule, they have not seen that everything is moving on as planned, according to FIFA advice. So they now say that, okay, officially they are going to leave office on December 2, which means that we're going to have elections at the regional level of Fecafoot in the country for the 10 regions, and then which will now have the members who make up the college to go to Yaoundé for the final elections for the national executive. So between now and December 2, these processes will be going on across Cameroon.
Cameroon football fans were not particularly happy with their Fecafoot's organizational ability at the World Cup that led to the abysmal performance of the indomitable Lions. How has been the reaction of the population of the football fraternity following the announcement that they will be leaving office by the end of the year?
No, of course, a lot of Cameroonians, they just want the current team to go as fast as possible. So they're just waiting for the official date, which is the end of November 2014. So Cameroonians are just saying that, okay, this is a timetable. We now, people who want to get into that office and take Cameroon football one step forward are now given the opportunity to put in their candidature. For instance, the new statutes indicate that the new president of the federation must stay in Yaoundé so that you can always be consulted or she can always be consulted anytime. And then, interestingly, those who will be going in as president of the federation, they have to pay a caution fee of France CFA, 2 million. So they want to put some seriousness into it. And then various commissions have been created, you know, to make Cameroon football more active, more vibrant. You know, like for the first time, we're going to have a commission in charge of animation and entertainment. So we, like, supporters guilds, supporters clubs are going to come up, register officially, who can move out and represent Cameroon in bigger numbers. You know, because if you discover when Cameroon is going for international competitions, we don't have a huge supporter team. We only have, officials who just go there, bloated officials who don't go there just to make money out of the federation and from the government.
So what happens to the president's demand for an investigation into the performance of both Fecafoot and the Indomitable Lions at the World Cup?
That is a seemingly an independent issue. At the close of this month, we are expecting the Prime Minister to tell Cameroonians what he has found out in the last 1 month. Cameroonians are on the edge, the media in Cameroon are on the edge, waiting for that report from the Prime Minister. Because people have to be sanctioned for the bad things that happened at the World Cup 2014 in Brazil. Cameroonians want to see people pay for the bad things that they have done for the country. So the media, the Cameroonian public, they are waiting for the Prime Minister's report at the close of this month. It's a very serious issue. Cameroonians are waiting.
Don't you think the government decision to investigate could be seen by FIFA as an interference and could possibly place sanctions on Fecafoot and, for that matter, Cameroon?
No. This issue about FIFA getting into football in the African continent, always saying that they are intervening, it's a worrying issue. It's worrying is that because the public opinion in Cameroon is that, and even in Nigeria, where the FIFA lifted the sanctions recently, the worry, Peter, is that the government puts a lot of money into football and individuals mismanage the money. And FIFA does not quarrel those individuals who mismanage money. Look at the way money was spent from Cameroon's government, from the federation's coffers in Brazil. The FIFA is not saying anything about that. FIFA is giving Cameroon a lot of billions of France CFA to run football in the country. The individuals are chopping their money. And then the football is not going ahead. Why is FIFA not quarreling with those people? So the government is stepping in to say that they run football and sporting activities in the country and the officials will be answerable to them. FIFA or no FIFA. Because what is happening is that it is the football of the country that must go forward. Football and sports in Cameroon is more than a game. I mean, it's life for the people. It's business for the people. So it must be handled with a lot of professionalism. That is what the government is saying.
Nana Walter Wilson is sports editor for the Post newspaper in Cameroon. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The president of the French Football Federation, Noël Lagrée, announced an agreement to adopt the use of spray to fix distances for free kicks in their walls at top-level matches in France this season. The highly popular practice, which sees officials spray the pitch with a white substance to keep walls at correct distance and also reduce their approachment of the ball placing, was a revelation at the recent World Cup in Brazil, where the first idea was used at the very highest level. Manchester United made an impressive debut under coach Louis van Gaal on Wednesday night, with Wayne Rooney scoring twice late in the first half of a 7-0 victory over the LA Galaxy. Van Gaal's tenure got off to a start, reflecting the confidence of United's veteran coach, who intends to return the 20-time English champions to immediate international prominence after David Moyes' poor tenure. United finished seventh in Moyes' only season as Alex Ferguson's replacement after 26 years, failing even to qualify for Europa League play. Chelsea's all-time top scorer and England international midfielder Frank Lampard has signed to play for Major League Soccer 2015 expansion side New York City FC, the club announced Thursday. Lampard spent his first six seasons at West Ham United with only a brief loan to Swansea in his debut season. He joined Chelsea in 2001 and bagged 211 goals for the Blues, as well as 29 in 106 caps for England. During Lampard's tenure, Chelsea won Premier League titles in 2005, 2006 and 2010, the FA Cup in 2007, 2009, 2010 and 2012, as well as the 2012 Champions League crown. And now here is Daybreak Africa Sports editor Mark Ouma with today's sports news roundup. Take it away, Mark.
We begin at the IAAF World Junior Athletics Championships in Eugene, Oregon State in the United States of America. Alemito Heroye and Alemito Hawi clinched a 1-2 Ethiopian triumph in women's 5,000 meters on Wednesday. Heroye edged Hawi for the gold medal in a time of 15 minutes and 10.08 seconds. Kenyan Agnes Jebet Tirop claimed the bronze medal, while Stella Chesang established a Uganda junior women's record of 15 minutes and 53.85 seconds. Earlier on, Wellington Zaza clocked 13.53 seconds to improve the Liberia junior men's 110-meter hurdles record in his semi-final. Zaza has qualified for the finals, while Avon Trinianina Rakoto Arimiandri ran a lifetime best of 51.96 seconds to establish a new Madagascar junior men's 400-meter hurdles record in his heat. He is through to the semi-finals. Staying in Eugene, Ethiopia is fourth on the medal table at the end of day two at the championships on Wednesday. They have a gold medal and a silver medal. Uganda is fifth, while Kenya is eighth among 18 countries on the medal table. Turning to women's football, despite a dip in performance at the last two editions of the Africa Women's Championships, Ghana is confident they'll excel at the event in Ufintuk, Namibia in October and qualify for the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyantiji explains.
Now, it's important that we make it to Canada 2015, having missed out on Germany 2011. We were in China 2007, and everyone knows the pedigree of Ghana in women's football. We have been to all the World Cups for the under-17 since 2008. For the under-20, we have been to the two previous World Cups. We are going to Canada this year, and that shows some consistency. Most of these young ladies who pass through the under-17 under 20 are now playing the senior team. So we now have a stronger team, and we are very hopeful that the team will make it to the World Cup.
That was Kwesi Nyantiji, Ghana Football Association president, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Mark Ouma is Daybreak Africa sports editor. Have a good evening, Mark. That's about all time will permit us for today on the sunny side of sport. I'm Peter Clotty. Back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, Peter. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, we have an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. While researchers are gathered in Melbourne, Australia for an international meeting on HIV/AIDS this week to share the latest on the search for a treatment and cure for the disease, its co-infections. President Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria and President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda are two African leaders who embrace legislation which targets the gay community. In Uganda, an anti-homosexuality law criminalizes same-sex relations, while in Nigeria, same-sex couples that show affection in public risk 10 years in prison. The laws in both countries are forcing communities vulnerable to HIV deeper into the shadows. We bring you this report.
In Uganda, religion is used as a weapon against homosexuality.
Don't decide tomorrow. Tomorrow may be too late for salvation.
Homosexuality is prohibited here in Uganda. We don't want it.
You get people, these mobs of people who are protesting, who are screaming, kill the gays, death to the gays. But it's not really about the gays. It's about them being frustrated with their own lives, and it's about the scapegoat, and it's about the government using gay people as a scapegoat.
And tell us not to stop the fight to protect our children from sodomy.
In Africa, homosexuality is against the law in 37 countries. The movie God Loves Uganda documents the influence of American evangelicals on anti-gay policies in Uganda.
American fundamentalist evangelicals have targeted Uganda for decades. And Uganda was a perfect storm because it was decimated, had the highest rate of HIV and AIDS in Africa. And so American evangelicals saw an opportunity and they moved in.
My goal is always to discourage sexual promiscuity of every sort. I believe that governments, all the governments of the world, have an affirmative duty to promote the natural family and marriage as the mainstream culture.
There is all of those things that is not God's way for love.
In Bible study classes like this one, they teach the belief that God does not love gays.
Nigeria and Uganda now are producing these pastors that were raised on this sort of idea that, you know, biblical law is above civil law. So what you're seeing now is the results of 30 years of American evangelicals being involved in the country.
In February of 2014, President Yoweri Museveni signed a bill outlawing same-sex relations in Uganda.
At best, it's paternalistic colonialism. At worst, it's outrageously racist to suggest that the Africans are children who cannot make up their own minds about what morality their country should follow.
A similar law was passed in Nigeria. Afani Arazuliki runs a clinic providing healthcare services for gay men in Abuja, Nigeria. 17% of gay men in Nigeria are HIV positive.
But we can't keep quiet for people to die or for people to lose their life. The law, on the other hand, we are battling the law because even people like us stand to go for 10 years imprisonment for doing what we're doing.
Baby, how are you?
Today, he is investigating a hate crime against a young gay teenager. Health officials in Uganda and Nigeria believe the new anti-gay laws will somehow lower HIV infection rates. Afani says the laws only promote violence and fear.
Ever since that night, the mobs attack, life has not been the same any longer in this community. You know, the beating, you know, they seized my phone.
Before the law, 15 new patients walked into his clinic every week. Now that number is down to 4.
The world is saying we want HIV-AIDS-free generation. We can't achieve that without including men who have sex with men. We can't achieve that without involving transgender people.
Nigerian officials say no one is being denied health services because of the law.
Where the law is concerned is when gays would go and congregate and show that we are gays and we are making love on the street and all of that. The law frowns at that. And treatment for any kind of disease in Nigeria is open to all citizens, irrespective of their status.
You cannot walk into a clinic, you cannot get drugs if you're HIV positive in Nigeria. It's nearly impossible. You are so
restricted, you are so stigmatized, you are so discriminated against by the healthcare industry. So for him to say that is crazy.
Undeterred, Afani presses on.
When I wake up every day, I want to do more. I want to see people smile. I want to see equality that is achieved across board in Nigeria someday of our life.
Afani is absolutely a hero. I think it's very hard for people in the West to understand exactly what he's up against, the hostility and hatred that he's up against, and that the fact that he refuses to back down and goes into the fire and faces it is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That was a VOA special report on AIDS.
Former Zimbabwean finance minister and presidential candidate Simba Mokone has pinned the country's ongoing economic crisis on President Robert Mugabe and his government. The leader of the opposition party, Mawambo Kusili Don, who contested the country's 2008 presidential elections, has also championed opposition unity against the ruling ZANU-PF party. In an interview with reporter Blessing Zulu, Mokone says President Mugabe has failed to make critical decision on issues that affect the country.
The Minister of Finance budget statement analyzed correctly the difficulties in our economy. Its consistency and reliability and credibility of government policies and their implementation. Throughout the history of our independence, government produces economic policies which they don't implement. So I would say that what needs to be done in the Zimbabwe economy is implementation consistently, persistently, and sustainably. But policies that government promulgates are not just slogans for the time being, and that policies are not scattered and abandoned in midstream, that investors, whether they are local investors, and there are many Zimbabweans who would like to invest in their country, who have no confidence that their investment is secure, or even if they are foreign, their concerns are exactly the same.
You were in government yourself for a number of years. Where exactly does the problem emanate from when it comes to the implementation matrix?
The problem emanates from our politics. Our government, particularly the head of state and government and commander-in-chief and all those titles he has, is a short-term person who wants to please people there and then. He has no staying power for difficult policies. So he then requires those who work under him to behave like he wants immediate gratification.
But those who support Mr. Mugabe will say sanctions negatively impacted on Zimbabwe's economy.
There are no sanctions, Blessing. You know that. Mugabe knows that. Everybody knows that. But even if there were, Blessing, Zimbabwe would not have been the first country to be under sanctions. Rhodesia grew under mandatory economic sanctions. Iraq was under economic sanctions. Iran is currently under economic sanctions, but their economies are not dwindling and declining like ours is. So Mugabe and his team have always been keen on passing the blame on scapegoats. It's time we accepted that we are our own liberators and that responsibility for our growth and development lies with us, not with other people. Other people can help us, indeed may help us, but primarily we can't bank our fate on other people when we ourselves are doing nothing.
Some are also saying the reason why ZANU-PF behaves the way it is behaving is because the opposition is very weak, and as a result it is giving Mr. Mugabe a blank check.
Well, there is no doubt that the opposition is weak, but that's no excuse, because Mugabe went to the electorate to seek a mandate to serve the people, not to serve the opposition. So it is a nonsense to make an argument like that.
Dr. Mokone, there is also this talk of a grand coalition. Are you in it?
I want to reaffirm what I said before. In January 2012, I called formally for a grand coalition for change. And I'm not claiming special credit for it, but I'm saying I'm one of those who has advocated that all Zimbabwean leaders, leaders in politics, leaders in business, leaders in the profession, leaders in civil society, and other categories of leadership need to work together to solve the problems that our people are confronting on a daily basis. So the answer to the first part of your question is yes, I am sorry. Am I in it? No, I'm not in it because a grand coalition doesn't exist yet.
Opposition party leader and former Zimbabwean finance minister Simba Makoni speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 18th, a group of Ethiopian bloggers and journalists detained for nearly 3 months were charged under the anti-terrorism proclamation. The six bloggers, who are part of a group known as Zone 9, and three independent journalists were arrested in April, prompting an outcry from international human rights and press freedom groups who said the case was an assault on press freedom. The United States is deeply troubled by the government of Ethiopia's decision to charge Ethiopian journalists with terrorism under the anti-terrorism proclamation. The Ethiopian government has an obligation to ensure that trial is fair, transparent, free of political influence, and in compliance with Ethiopia's constitutional guarantees and international human rights obligations. The United States also urges the government to ensure that the trial is open to public observation. The U.S. reiterates its call on Ethiopia to refrain from using anti-terrorism laws as a mechanism to curb the free exchange of ideas. The use of the anti-terrorism proclamation in previous cases against journalists, activists, and opposition political figures raises serious questions and concerns about the intent of the law and about the sanctity of Ethiopians' constitutionally guaranteed rights to freedom of the press and freedom of expression. Fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, do not change with new technologies. Like all human rights, the right to freedom of expression resides with the individual. It is not for governments to dole out or deny as they see fit. Freedom of expression and freedom of the press are fundamental elements of a democratic society. The arrest of journalists and bloggers and their prosecution under terrorism laws has a chilling effect on the media and all Ethiopians' right to freedom of expression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.